Don't call it a podcast or my boss will get mad at me. And I am Scott, and with me tonight is Mr. Fraser Ronald of Swords Edge Publishing, and we're going to talk about a couple of his most recent games and probably some other random tangents that happen, as they do. But feel free to elaborate on who you are.
My name's Fraser Ronald. I do Swords Edge Publishing as well as a podcast called Accidental Survivor, which can be found at accidentalsurvivors.com. And yeah, that I'm a dad, and I'm also a fiction writer with a few short stories out there. Most recently in Blackgate number 15. Run out and buy it now.
Buy two.
Tell him Fraze sent you.
So I guess we'll just launch into Sword Noir, which is, how would you pitch Sword Noir?
Sword Noir is, if you want the elevator pitch, imagine Conan in the Maltese Falcon or Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser running through the big sleep. It's sword and sorcery meets hard-boiled detective fiction meets film noir. Ergo, Sword Noir.
All right. So what sort of tripped that little switch in your brain that was like, I need to write a game that is sword and sorcery and noir all at once? What, did you just spend a lot of time reading Garrett P.I. or something?
Although Glenn Cook is my probably my favorite fantasy author, or at least up there in the top three, I'm not a fan of his Garrett books. What I actually found was in my own short fiction, this was what I was gravitating towards. The kind of plots and concepts, tropes that you would find in hard-boiled detective fiction. And when I realized that, I started to actually focus my writing into that genre. It was something that was happening anyways, and it became more of a conscious effort. And when I did that, because my other love is role-playing games, I decided I wanted to try to replicate that in a role-playing game. And so it really began as an exercise that bore fruition when I played Jaws of the Six Serpents, which is a PDQ game, and it's sword and sorcery. It's straight sword and sorcery. And I found in that a foundation, a skeleton on which I could build what Sword Noir. It did sword and sorcery, the Conan style, heroic sword and sorcery very well, but it wouldn't have worked for Sword Noir. So I decided to I hack games all the time. It's a little quirk of mine. So I decided to bolt on a bunch of other pieces from other games, including things like Lady Blackbird, Savage Worlds, Fate, Shadow of Yesterday, all of these onto Jaws of Six Serpents and PDQ itself to create something that I've, in playtesting and in playing since, replicated the kind of game that I saw as Sword Noir.
All right, so you mentioned sort of the mashup mechanics. So what elements have you pulled from all these various games to make this, I don't know, stew of swordiness and noirness?
The main spine is the concept of qualities, which is also very much like aspects in Fate.
No. You've got to keep my stew metaphor going, so it's the broth.
It's the broth. PDQ is the broth in which I've cooked all of these things. And the chunky meat is the vegetables are. Well, from Savage Worlds, I took the idea of wounds as tokens. And from Lady Blackbird, I took the I'm trying to remember exactly now. It's actually quite some time ago. The clearest fate, the aspects mixed with qualities, and the rating system as well. So it's actually difficult to say which part came from which. They all inspired it, and I'm sure if I went back and looked at my development documents, I could probably tell you. But if you've played any of those games and you play Sword Noir, you'll probably be able to tell me where I stole stuff from. Pivots basically come from Shadow of Yesterday. I remember that quite clearly.
And what are pivots, for the sake of clarification?
Pivots in Sword Noir is how you advance. Now, it's different in Kiss My Axe. In Kiss My Axe, it's how you gain luck. But in Sword Noir, it's how you advance. And a pivot is a goal or a character quirk that once you hit allows you to advance. So, for example, Conan might have I'll maintain my barbaric concept of honor, and when tempted by civilization and the decadence of it, and he does not succumb, even though this might end up impacting negatively on the character in the game mechanically, Conan would get the advance. And then with the advance, you can buy a new rank, which is how, instead of like points, everything's in ranks. And each rank is basically +2 on a die roll. It's 2d10 versus the target number.
Okay, so over the course of coming up with this genre mash, what did you find really made it all blend and stick together?
Well, I actually had a concept paragraph, if you will, that outlined exactly what I saw Sword Noir to be. And every time I looked at a rule or thought about a rule, I went back to that and tried to find if it matched what I was saying Sword Noir was. So that was kind of my test. And so if something didn't fit, something didn't seem to work, then I would be looking at this concept paragraph and trying to find some way to replicate that within the game itself on a mechanical level. And that's why sometimes I'd be reading something, for example, let's say Savage Worlds, and the level of violence and the threat of violence that I wanted to include in Sword Noir seemed to me to be well replicated by the wound mechanics from that. And so that's basically how I used each of these to how I took pieces from everything and bolted them on to or I should say cut them up and dropped them in the Sword Noir stew.
So you talk about characters from sword and sorcery fiction in a noir setting, and does that sort of go the other way where you could have more noirish characters in the sword and sorcery adventures, or is this very much noir first and sword and sorcery second, or an equal blend?
The noir is very much in the hands of the GM, because the noir concept is much more about the plot. So when you're building the characters being built are certainly sword and sorcery, but they're a very specific kind of sword and sorcery in that they've been built with the idea of the hardboiled detective, or just hardboiled fiction in general, in mind. Meaning that to these characters, violence would likely never be the first option because it is, in fact, deadly. And one mistake can put your character down and done with. Just as if you're a heroic character and you're facing, for example, a minion, which is the lowest kind of character you can meet, you're probably not going to be threatened, but one good roll, and yeah, it might be all over for you.
How have people responded to that level of lethality? Because it's not especially common in fantasy gaming.
No, it's not. What I've found actually in the playtesting and in feedback from people who have purchased it is that sometimes players need to be reminded that it's not D&D or it's not Savage Worlds or it's not GURPS or whatever. But once they clue into that, it runs pretty well. The combat can certainly work. Now, there's three types of characters. There's the minion, which is the most basic level of character, and all a minion is a concept, like thug or merchant or bartender. And then you have a regular, what's called a regular character. And regular characters are slightly more rounded than the minion, but they don't have all of the build that a heroic character does. And the heroic character is the player character. They're also, for example, the big bad evil guy or the main foe that the characters have to overcome. Now, when it comes to lethality, sure, if you're facing a group of thugs, you're probably okay, although the rules for multiple opponents really penalize someone fighting a large group. But if you're like, if there's a couple of minions and you have your PC heroic character, you're probably okay to get into a fight. Sure, you might get unlucky, but depending. If your character's built for combat, probably not. And that's something that's important to mention. These characters are supposed to be specialists. So they're good at what they do. So while you have a much bigger, better build than a minion or a regular, if you don't focus on something, you're going to end up being jack of all trades and master of none. Meaning that, sure, you might have a slight advantage in combat over another character, but you're not going to be anywhere near as good as the player that focused their character on combat. So building the swordsman. If you wanted to build a trickster or a confidence man, when you get into social situations, that character is going to dominate. In combat, the character's not going to dominate. So again, if you had a combat character against these minions, these almost nothing characters, even a few of them, you're going to take them down. You're going to take them down fast. But when you face to another heroic character, you're probably going to try to find a way of meeting the challenge without drawing the sword. And again, that's if you read hard-boiled fiction, while characters like Sam Spade and Continental Op and Philip Marlowe are tough guys when necessary and backed into a corner, in general, they'll talk their way out of a fight or they'll take a beating and just accept it, especially if the odds are against them. Because in hard-boiled fiction, the violence is very real. It's very threatening. So that is something that is drawn into a sword and war game, and it's a mechanical piece that, even though it's there in the rules, sometimes players need to be reminded of, and that can easily be done through the GM and the kind of games and the surroundings that the characters are put into. And it may also need to be an out-of-character reminder, like, I don't think you really want to get into this fight.
So, sometimes you can hint and you can nod and you can cajole, but sometimes you just got to say, you're going to die, dude. Do you feel like dying right now?
You really want to lose that character? Because that's what I'm seeing.
Sometimes you just have to say.
Or sometimes they just have to let it happen. If you give the warning and the player's still pushing forward, it's like, okay, well, let's just see what happens. And that might be a good lesson. I really wouldn't want to do that in a game. If somebody's really pushing, I'd say, would you like to see how combat works? So we can run a combat and you can have a better idea of what you're getting yourself into before you actually do this.
Because there's that one guy who will go to violence regardless.
I've been really lucky. Now, there have been a couple of instances in the playtest where that did happen, but generally it only happened once. And most of the time, especially in my group, my home group that I regularly play with, are well aware that when I say combat really shouldn't be an option in this game, they know I mean it. So we didn't really have, and there's no guy who's... another thing to talk about, and the reason I'm thinking about this, because I was about to say, my players trust me and I trust them. And that is built into this game as well. Now, in some games, the balance is so strong in the mechanics because there seems to be a philosophy that the GM needs to be protected from the players, or the players need to be protected from the GM or from each other. And in this game, that does not exist. There's a certain level of balance in that everybody gets the same number of ranks with which to build their characters, but there's no sense of balance in that the GM is protected from the players or the players are protected from the GM. The idea is that you all trust one another. And that also follows through with the idea that if the GM is saying, listen, so this is Sword Noir, it's a mashup of sword and sorcery and hard-boiled fiction, but you have to understand it's not the kind of sword and sorcery that we used to play with D20 or with Savage Worlds. This is a more lethal one, and you might want to be worried about getting into a fight. And hopefully that's all it's going to take for the player to say, okay, I gotcha.
Well, and I think you bring up trust between players and game masters, and it's sort of this strange idea, because obviously I spend a lot of time listening to various role-playing podcasts and across all sorts of formats, and something that keeps coming up is that there are basically two rules to making your game work, and if you follow them, you'll be fine 90% of the time, is that one, you don't be a dick, and two, you trust each other. And it's kind of odd that really the three biggest games on the market don't seem to think about those two steps and instead just build rules around that to make it all happen.
And that is true. And I think perhaps it's because, just from my own experience, so it's only anecdotal and certainly not statistical, but what I remember
Well, do we have any statistical evidence at all in this hobby for anything?
Absolutely not.
Like, there's the sales numbers that everyone likes to quote, and those are half made up.
Well, I mean, Sorted Publishing, we put our sales numbers out every month, as does Evil Hat.
And good on both of you.
If you're interested in those, I mean, we're a tiny, 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 tiny company, and Evil Hat is second or third tier. I mean, after Dresden, after they put out Dresden Files, I mean, they're up there in probably second tier. But in any case, as I recall in my own experience as a player and as a GM, a lot of the people that I did meet in this hobby were dicks. And it was a good thing that there were rules to protect me and to protect them, because a lot of times it was almost competitive, but not in a good sense. GMs would get upset when the players outsmarted their big trap rather than applaud the ingenuity. Or if one other player got some kind of advantage, some players would get angry and then try to ruin that advantage for the character, the magic sword, and steal it and sell it. And these crazy things. And I can never understand, like, why are you so pissed off? Aren't we here to have fun? And so I've been lucky, as I got into my adult years, in the groups that I played with in university and then outside of university, have all been very good, and there has not been that level of competition. It's always been very cooperative, and that's what I've kind of built into Sword Noir, the idea that it's cooperative, that this is not your game, speaking mostly to the GMs, it's everyone's game, and everyone's going to work together to reach the goal, and the goal is to have fun.
Yeah, and, well, new version of D&D on the way. Maybe they'll clue in.
I highly doubt it. Maybe. And, I mean, again, if you look at probably, if they did statistical analysis, and there certainly was the one poll that they did, 2000, just before 3E came out.
Yeah, that big pile of
exactly,
research
yeah.
they did.
I mean, if they did something similar again, they might find themselves that a large percentage, or at least a significant portion of their consumers do actually need rules to protect from each other.
Oh, and spending time on the Wizards boards, it sounded like it. Which is why I don't hang out on the Wizards boards anymore.
I mean, anybody that's listened to Axiom Survivors or visited my website, swordjudge.ca or swordjudgepublishing.ca, either one, probably knows I'm not a player of 4E. And that's not because it's a bad game. It's just I can't play the kind of games I want. I've been a player of 4E. I think it works fine for what it does, but I've been out since, since 4E came along. And before that, I had left D20 for the much more simple and elegant True 20.
And I guess going to simple and elegant, Sword Noir, including cover pages, is what, like 72? That's the page count?
And the mechanics, if you boil down the mechanics, which I have, there's a free product out there called Sword's Edge System, which is the very basic game on which Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe are built. If you go to Sword's Edge System, that is everything, all the mechanics that are necessary, including a magic system, in less than 20 pages.
Yeah, that seems about right. There were some big art pages between chapters.
Mm-hmm, yep, there's a lot of discussion. One thing that Sword Noir does is it expands on the magic system. One of the reasons is that this is something that's out of Sword and Sorcery as opposed to hard-boiled fiction. In Sword and Sorcery, while the only main character in Sword and Sorcery that plays with magic is Elric. And other than that,
Elric does not play well with magic, though.
Exactly. Like, magic is a dark, deadly force that punishes those that use it and that drives people insane or drives them into the arms of the demonic. So that was something that had to be built into Sword Noir, which actually expanded on the size of the rules. Another thing that's included in Sword Noir that isn't included in Sword Judge System is a step-by-step discussion of building a character. So for each section, like for aspects and traits and qualities, I'm building an example character. And then the player character sheet, the example, what has been built is in the back. But there are pieces of the character sheet throughout the book showing you how this will look if you built it this way. So that's another thing. I mean, Sword's Edge System doesn't have that. It's very pared down. It's also free. But yeah, if you get right to the mechanics, it's 20 pages or less. And the reason for that is that that was that's the market that I set for myself. And I've said before, the only kind of game I'm interested in learning now are games that are less than 20 pages of mechanics. If you want to put in a lot of examples and fluff and stuff like that, I'm all good with that. But the bottom line is I'm getting old. I don't have a lot of time. I only want 20 pages of mechanics or less.
Which is, and this sort of brings up an idea about Fate, is that, you know, the mechanics seem so very simple, but I have yet to see a Fate book that runs less than, what, 400 pages?
Exactly. And, I mean, I bought a bunch of Fate books, and I love the system, but you're right. It's like, wait, this is a really simple system. Why does it take so much space? There are reasons for that. There's mechanical reasons for that. There's builds and options and explanations, etc. I mean, it's not that I would never run Fate, but again, like, I tend to prefer games that are a lot simpler. I mean, I've got these my own systems that I run with now. But if, for example, I wanted to play just a straight sword and sorcery, the kind of thing I used to use D&D and then True 24, I would just use old school hack. And for those of you out there who haven't seen any award-winning old school hack by any award-winning Kieran Robinson, you really need to go check it out. It's free. It's at, like, I think oldschoolhack.net, I believe.
Yeah.
But it's like 12 pages. And Kieran's a graphic designer, and the way he's built the rules, they're very it takes you right through the process. A fair number of those 12 pages are character sheets themselves. The character sheets are awesome. Like, this is a really, really simple game to learn. And I was lucky enough at the most recent Gen Con 2011 to go through a game run by Kieran Robinson. And I loved the game before, and after seeing what the master does with it, I love it even more. It's fantastic.
All right. I actually have a copy of Old School Hack sitting on my hard drive, and I just looked at it. And the entire file is 26 pages. Most of that is character sheets and little tokeny things.
Yes, the tokens, and also the there's little cards for the for the phases of action and stuff. It's just really well designed.
Yeah. Very neat things in that little thing. But I guess you brought up magic systems, and this will be a good way to transition into Kiss My Axe. Is that between Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe, you seem to have shied away from the more typical RPG magic system. Is that just your preference in genre, or do you really not want to design a magic system that extensive?
Well, number one, I don't want to design a magic system that extensive, and number two, for both Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe, I was dragged into having a magic system kicking and screaming. And it was only because I'm aware that there's a large percentage of the role-playing game population, especially for fantasy, be it historic fantasy or like Sword Noir mashup fantasy, that won't play a game that they can't play someone who uses magic. The fact being that in Sword and Sorcery, like we said, Elric's your main character, and nobody else really does. And my absolute favorite Sword and Sorcery characters are Fafnir the Greymouser, followed by Conan and then Solomon Kane. And none of these characters use magic. And in fact, sometimes magic is used by supporting characters to assist them, but in general, it's used by the villains. So if it's only used by the villains or supporting characters, you don't need a mechanical system. It's all narrative. You tell the players. You don't need to roll dice for that. What does the villain need to do? Like, what's the attack? That kind of thing. Especially if it's supporting. What are they? How are they supporting? They're healing? Fine, they healed. Like, you don't really need mechanics for that. But yes, there's a large percentage of people that want to use magic, so fine. Created a sword in Sword Noir, created a magic system that was much more akin to Sword and Sorcery. Kiss My Axe is much more difficult because there's not even the inspiration that I use for Kiss My Axe. None of them have magic in them except for the Saga of the Norse. And among the Sagas of the Norse, the magic is narrative. Move the story forward, and it's legendary and mythical certainly, but it is, I mean, this is still literature. And so building the magic system for Kiss My Axe, I wanted it to be much more abstract and open than what I had for Sword Noir. But what I found was that doesn't really work in a role-playing game. Perhaps it can work in some systems, but when I left it open, the big problem that I found was when people failed at something, they would just keep trying until they succeeded. Now, number one, that's not a lot of fun. Number two, the game. And number three, it doesn't seem very... it's not in keeping with those sagas of the Norse, which were the only examples of magic. So I added in a little thing about fatigue. That was the thing to restrain people from using it over and over again. But other than that, the magic system is pretty straightforward. It's also very similar to the one that was in Jaws the Sixth Serpent from Tim Gray and Silver Branch Games, which was the broth in which Kiss My Axe is built as well. It's a very abstract system where you look at how what are you trying to do? Okay, well, is it the same kind of energy that's in a hearth fire? Is it the same kind of energy that's in a forest fire? Is it the strength of a child, the strength of a man? How far away is it? How many people? And that will give you both the amount of time it takes to cast the magic and the target number that you need to roll to actually succeed at what you're doing. And it's important to note, again, yes, you can play a magic using character, but magic is slow. So in combat... you can't really cast magic in combat. The good thing is the combat in Kiss My Axe is also extremely abstract. And there's no, like, this is your weapon, this is your plus hit, this is your damage. No. You roll 2d10, you add your qualities that are applicable to combat or the attack, and you see how well you succeeded. And the level of your success is a level of damage. Meaning that if you want to say narratively that I call forth lightning from the skies to smite my opponents, okay, you call forth lightning from the skies to smite your opponents. Awesome. Thor loves you.
Thor digs that.
He loves the lightning.
Yeah. And the smiting.
Oh, the smiting is good. Especially if it's giants. He likes smiting giants.
Yeah. Thor can be, and I'm just going to quote Kevin Hearn's books here, kind of a dick.
In the Elder Edda with Snorri Sturluson, one of the things that Thor kind of comes across as is very much like, and not pejoratively, like a jock. He's a big, good-natured party boy that, you know, how do you fix this problem? Well, you break it, like you punch something. But he's also very quick to forgive, right? So, I mean, and this is the thing with Loki. As many times as Loki has done tricks that either are on Thor or put Thor in the position of trying to clean up a mess, he always forgives, and especially because Loki's good at acting contrite, whether he is or not. I like that idea of Thor. I mean, it's something that is missing in, for example, the Marvel comics, and it's also something that was missing in the adaptation of those comics. But, I mean, I like that Thor, too. That Thor's one as well.
Yeah, well, at that point, Marvel Comics has drifted so far, you kind of stop thinking of him as the Norse Thor and just think of him as Jack Kirby's Thor.
Well, the Walt Simonson run was fantastic in bringing back the Norse mythology into the Thor comic books. And I own the entire original run in the little plastic baggies with the cardboard backing of Walt Simonson.
Very important. Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, it'll be ruined
forever.
Oh, God, it'll
be terrible. But that's not an inspiration that included in Kiss My Axe because it didn't really inform the kind of game that I was creating there. But that was one of the inspirations, one of the reasons why I love Norse mythology was how Walt Simonson brought it into the superhero genre.
But yes, okay, I guess we've alluded to this, but Kiss My Axe is a game about what exactly?
It's all about the Vikings. It's when I ran this at Gen Con, I did it at Games on Demand, which is this awesome place where you go. It's not programmed. It's not like you'll find this game at this time. You go there if you want to play a game, and you pay a certain amount to for a slot. And there's a bunch of different people running different games. So there actually might not be anything that you want to play. But while I was there, Jason Morningstar was running Fiasco. I mean, how can you not jump at that? I had a bunch of different things. I had Sword Noir. I had Kiss My Axe. I had something for True 20, and I had something for Old School Hack. They suggested just have as many different games as possible. And whenever I said, you know, people are like, well, what's Sword Noir about? Okay, what's Kiss My Axe about? Sword Noir, even with an elevator pitch, takes a little bit of time to comprehend. Kiss My Axe? What's Kiss My Axe about? Viking mayhem. Okay, I'll play that.
Like, being a Viking is something that you will understand almost on an instinctive
exactly.
level. It's like, where's my boat? Where's my sword? Where's my things that need a
exactly. I mean, it's such a, and it is, it's such a paradigm for gaming. I mean, granted, a lot of people think of the Vikings when they think of barbarians, if they don't think of Conan first. And they might think of horned helmets and that sort of thing. But it doesn't matter. We all have a concept of what the Vikings are and what they did and why they were important. And so when you say something like Viking Mayhem, also the subtitle of the book is 13 Warriors and an Angel of Death. And the top inspiration for this is the movie The 13th Warrior. And that is the kind of approach it takes to the Vikings. As much as it's also informed by actual historical research and fact, it's much more informed by the fiction that we've built up around Vikings. And because of that, you can ignore the negative aspects of the Vikings and you can embrace the positive aspects of the Vikings. The fact is that if you look at what the Vikings considered good, like they're in the book, I call it their ethos. I mean, things like glory, loyalty, generosity, hospitality, fearlessness, cunning. These are things that we can all say are good. And you can ignore the rape, the murder of innocents, and those sorts of things, and create heroic Vikings. I mean, a lot of times in our fiction, that's what we do, and a lot of times in the sagas themselves, they don't focus on the killing of monks. Now, granted, by the time that these were being written down, they were being written down by people who had been Christianized. So these were Christianized. Most of the famous sagas were Christianized Icelandic sagas. So they're not going to talk about the murder of Christian monks because that's not something glorious that they want their heroes to do. So we can focus on those awesome aspects of the Viking and the ones that are part of our mass media idea of what a Viking is and have a lot of fun doing that and just ignore the crappy stuff.
Okay, so you mentioned The 13th Warrior, which was a pretty cheesy movie based on a very cheesy Michael Crichton novel. Or maybe the other way around. Very cheesy movie, cheesy Michael Crichton novel. Which I didn't read, might actually do it. But I'm sure it had a works cited page that was altogether too long for a work of fiction.
Exactly. And, I mean, the Eaters of the Dead, which is the movie, which is the book the movie is based on, was actually an attempt to fail. I believe it was a graduate class in university. That the Beowulf legend was based on the writings of an Arab scholar. And the Arab scholar that he picked actually existed and did meet Vikings in modern-day Bulgaria. And then Michael Crichton basically took it from there. And those Vikings ended up being the ones that were involved in the Beowulf legend. But instead of Grendel, it was this – just like in The 13th Warrior, it was this like group of Cro-Magnon or Neanderthal or whatever they were that had survived in Scandinavia and were kind of, for whatever population pressures or whatever, were once again expanding from their home and had run into the Vikings and were like wiping them out.
How does one play a Viking in your game?
One plays a Viking by being absolutely awesome. And this is the point of this game, and this is how it differs dramatically from Sword Noir, is that combat is an essential part of being a Viking. There's two things to being a Viking. When I was starting to build this, not only did I look at these inspirations, which is why I listed the inspirations in the book, because this is, instead of having a paragraph, almost like a mission statement for the game, I had these inspirations that I wanted the game to replicate for me. And one thing that happened that was consistent is they fight and they sail. And those are the two consistent things about Vikings no matter what. So those are the two things that had to happen in this game. The sailing part was easy. You've got a quality called seafaring, and everyone's got it. So there you go. You're all sailing. That's awesome. And then the fighting part. The fighting took a little bit more. I had to totally change my view of combat. In Sword Noir, there are certain restrictions on what you can do, not what you can do in combat, but how you can modify combat, how you can use certain aspects and traits and qualities in combat. Kiss My Axe actually gives you aspects for combat that you can use. So and they're grouped together into something called prowess, and it's basically your fighting, which is self-explanatory. then there's protection, which is also kind of self-explanatory. It doesn't necessarily need to be armor, but it can be, for example, too fast for you, or was there a second ago, or my blade's in your way. All these things could be used for protection. It's basically just a quality that can be used in defense. Then you've got style. Style is used for attack, and the only way that you can use style is if you describe your attack cinematically. So if you, for example, if you were an archer, a good example, one that I regularly use, happened at the Games on Demand and Gen Con, where the archer scaled a tree and then like exploded out of the leaves, loosing his arrow as he did, taking the guy right in the throat and killing him, and then landing on the roof beside the dead body. Pretty cinematic. Another one was intimidation. The barbarian had the style of intimidation. And what she did was she kept pulling out different weapons. She was actually facing a group of guys. She kept pulling out different weapons. Like, she pulls out a regular sword. Not big enough. Throws it away. Pulls out a big battle axe. Not big enough. Throws it away. Pulls out like a flail, like a massive flail. Nope. Two swords. Nope. Finally, by the time she reaches the guy, she's got these two big axes in her hand. She's like, yeah, that'll do. And they're all just pissing themselves. And that's how she did her style of intimidation. Again, very cinematic. So you have to be cinematic to use style. Now, that adds both to the mechanics of the game, because this is a modifier that you can use in specific circumstances, but it also adds to the atmosphere of the game, because you've got all these – anytime you're in a fight, you're not going to have a lot of, okay, well, I swing my sword. Oh, you miss. Or I swing my sword. Oh, you hit. He's dead. You're going to have cool things like, okay, so I block his blade, I twist down, and I go low with my sword, and I cut him off at the knees. Stuff like that, which again is going to – it's and especially people start feeding off each other. It's like, ooh, that's awesome. Now I have to top that. And it makes combat very cinematic. It makes it exciting, and that's the kind of thing that I liked about 13th Warrior. That's the kind of thing I like about the Norse sagas. That's the kind of thing I like in my game. It's doing awesome, fun stuff that people really enjoy. And hopefully you'll do it outside of combat as well. But there is literally a mechanic in combat that doesn't make you. You don't have to take style. But there are mechanical benefits to taking style. So it does tend to make combat, number one, a lot more fun. And number two, a lot more common than in Sword Noir.
Your basis is the Norse sagas, and that jives well with the cinematic style because, you know, in the Norse sagas, dudes were swimming oceans,
yep,
and beating things to death with their own arms.
Yeah.
But obviously, Vikings are real dudes who did real things for a number of centuries. And how do you balance that historical element to the game?
Well, one thing that I do is I include a lot of historical settings. Now, because this is technically a historical fantasy, we look at real-world history, and I look at a bunch of different periods in real-world history. For example, the Scandinavian Bronze Age, which the Proto-Germanics, as they called them, basically the Norse, had arrived in what we now call Scandinavia. So this is when you can begin your games of Vikings, and a lot of this stuff is exactly the same. The only thing that's different in these periods before the Viking Age, before basically the 8th century, is that they didn't have the shipbuilding technology that turned the Norse into the Vikings. So there's these different historical periods, and we talk about what you can expect from the what kind of adventures you would have in that period, who the Norse were at that time, and what they would be doing. And then when we went to the Viking Age, what I include is different regions and kind of the Vikings touched not all, but a fair portion of not just the known world, but the entire world. And it's very easy to explain the way almost any individual from any geographic region in the world finding their way onto a Viking ship and joining a war band. I think the example I give in the book is a Mesoamerican. Well, let's say your Mesoamerican adventurer made his way or her way up through North America, meeting the various native tribes until they reached what the Vikings called Vinland the Good, and there ran into a band of Vikings. So this would have to be the 10th or 11th century. And that band of Vikings, because your Mesoamerican character was so awesome, invited the Mesoamerican character to join their war band. You could even have for example, an Aborigine from Australia who, out fishing one day, was blown off course, found himself in Indonesia, worked her way through the islands till she reached mainland China, and then followed the Silk Road into what the Vikings called Circland, which we would call the Middle East, and there again met a trading party of Vikings. And by that time, I mean, after all these adventures, she's obviously so competent and capable at what she does. The Vikings absolutely want her on board.
I've always sort of frowned upon the phrase "the known world" because, you know, everyone in the world knows where they're
exactly.
at.
Exactly. They know some part of it.
And you do get these cultures that seem to be a little bit farther than you really thought they were, like China and the Norsemen.
Mm-hmm.
Just floating around, finding crazy places. Maybe they'll stick around because the natives aren't so nice. But
in a lot of instances, that is true.
But, you know, they were around.
And there were always connections, linking.
Something about the boldness of the human spirit.
And yada, yada, yada.
Yada, 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 Captain Kirk
exactly.
speech. Done. All right, and you obviously talk about being badass in this game, so I take it you don't really start out at level one where you've got your rusty knife and your pants and you really hope you don't run into anything more threatening than kobolds
exactly.
for the first few sessions. I'm guessing that is not the scenario
although much
that you encourage.
Much like Sword Noir, this is a game about specializing. Now, you can be a jack-of-all-trades. It's not the end, because one of the things you want is be awesome and get spotlight. And the only way that you can be awesome and get the spotlight is be the best at what you do. Now, what you do might be fighting, and maybe you got just a group of guys that just kick ass or kick axe. And so in combat, everything is really awesome. Well, that means that in you're pretty much all your adventures are just going to have to be combat. But there were merchants, the Vikings, the guys that were really good at trade. There was your leaders. There were the Skalds. And there's all these other kinds of Vikings that can certainly include, can be included in your warband. They still have fighting, the quality of fighting, and they can still put things into style if you want. They're not going to be as good at combat as a combat monster that you build, but would have all these other skills. And if you build characters, you have enough ranks to build characters that can literally do legendary things. Now, the target numbers are described by a single adjective, and legendary mythic is as tough as it gets. And you can build characters right from the outset that can achieve these mythic challenges or legendary challenges. So yeah, you're not first level. That's a minion. The first level D&D character, the first level magic user, and not so much in 4e, but in the old versions, your first level magic user is your minion. Your first level ranger from 1e might be a regular character, but your heroic characters, your player characters are out there, and they can do legendary deeds.
Obviously, not everyone wants the big epic out of the gate, and what do you say to those guys?
If they don't want to be epic out of the gate, there's nothing forcing them to be epic out of the gate. I think that building your character so that the character can reach legendary challenges does not necessarily require you to face epic challenges. And I think for me, I tend not to be epic. Now, the campaign that I was running for Kiss My Axe, it originally started as a true 20 Viking campaign, but it was, while it included things like Loki burning their ship, it started out very grounded. And what they were trying to get wasn't about saving the world or killing the gods or anything like that. They were bound into this by destiny, which may sound epic, but in my idea of epic, and again, this might be the wrong definition, my idea of epic is usually...
Well, just to say so, the definition of epic is really long poem.
That is true.
That is the original definition of epic. Subsequent connotations it's taken on are entirely in your own
mind. There you go. So no, it's not about really long poetry. So we don't need to worry about that.
But if you're like super awesome Skald man,
yep.
you can write your long
poem. If you really want, then you can have an epic in the game. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that you can run, you can either run the gods are coming back to destroy the world and you are the only characters that can save it, or you can run the, hey, we found ourselves in the land of the Slavs, let's raid a village. Although the challenges mechanically are called legendary, it doesn't necessarily mean that they will be built of legends.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about how magic works in Kiss My Axe.
So magic works in Kiss My Axe based on the runes, which is really how one of the ways that the Vikings saw it, the Norse saw it, and they saw it as being taken from taken by Odin from the Well of Knowledge. In Kiss My Axe, based on the number of ranks you put into your magic, you get a certain number of runes, and each of these runes has aspects. So if you want to cast magic, you have to build your magic spell using the aspects you have access to through these runes. And then, like Sword Noir, depending on what you're trying to do, how far away, how big of an area or a number of people, how much energy it would require, that decides your target number and the number of rounds it will take to build up this magic. It's interesting because the actual narrative qualities of the magic play into that. In general, almost all magic was considered feminine. There was one type of magic that was considered masculine, and that actually required a seven-line rhyming verse to cast. So it certainly does fit the idea of it's going to take you, you know, six rounds to do anything. The feminine aspect of magic has basically been removed. I've mentioned it in the rules, but there's no mechanical penalty if you're a male using what the Vikings called feminine magic. However, it might be a very interesting aspect to play in the game as for role playing. And this, the Vikings and the Norse had very, very strong ideas about gender roles. So, for example, we know of no women that have sailed with the Vikings. That's not to say none did, but if they did, they probably dressed as men and did not let anybody know that they were women. A man that undertook the feminine versions of magic would almost certainly be killed. Now, this is only true of the Norse. If you're a foreigner, it doesn't count because you're a foreigner anyway. So, you know,
you're weird.
Exactly.
Crazy. You're weird and strange.
So yeah. So of course you do women's stuff. Like, you're a Finn. What can we expect? But if you were Norse, then that's a problem. It's interesting. In the games on demand that I keep referring to at Gen Con, one of the players...
Well, clearly it was a good experience.
It was a fantastic experience. And one of the players decided to make a Muslim wizard. And it worked out fantastic, especially since, you know, it's almost very much like 13th Warrior. Could you call your character Ahmed Ibn Fadlan, please? I'd like that.
More on the fantasy of this is what sort of fantastical elements do we see in play? Are we going to be fighting crazy monsters all the time? Are we going to have elves? Is Loki going to show up in torture boat every other week?
It's certainly available. Unlike Sword Noir, the Kiss My Axe does include a very limited bestiary, because when you look at the sagas, really what they're fighting are variations of giants. We translate into a bunch of different things like trolls, ogres, et cetera, but really all they are different kinds of giants. So you've got your basic giant, and you've got your basic troll, your fire giant, your frost giant. And then I threw in the berserker because, you know, you're probably going to run across one of them sooner or later. And then the two different kind of elves, that the light elf and the dark elf, the Leos Elfar and the Svart Elfar, which, oddly enough, the Svart Elfar, the dark elf, evolved into what we can, through literature and time, became what we call the dwarf. Although in the actual Norse literature, there's no indication that they're shorter, although they do live in the earth. But these are included because if you want to fight scary monsters, it's certainly part of the sagas, and it's certainly part of the idea of Norse mythology. So in Sword Noir, there were no monsters because, number one, in Sword and Sorcery, they're actually relatively rare. And certainly in hard-boiled fiction, they don't exist. So I didn't feel that monsters really fit. Whereas in Kiss My Axe, with the Vikings, their own stories talk about fighting these beasts and strange apparitions all the time. And certainly this isn't a complete bestiary of the different kinds of things that you can come across. If you do some reading in Norse mythology, there's all sorts of different spirits and monsters. But again, it's not that difficult to actually build monsters with Kiss My Axe. Character creation itself, once you understand how the system works, character creation itself is probably like 10-15 minutes. And the same thing for monsters, depending on what level you want. Again, you can have minion monsters, you can have regular monsters, but usually monsters are kind of a special realm on their own between the regular and the heroic, in that depending on how much of a challenge you want to present. So your average troll might be a slight challenge to a combat-heavy character, but a giant certainly should be something that will make the combat-heavy character worried about facing alone. But again, once you understand how the mechanics work, building a monster, once you know what you want out of that monster, should only take about 5-10 minutes. And, I mean, yes, I design the rules, but I do it on the fly all the time. It's really quite easy.
Yeah. Okay. And I appreciate that personally, because the second a game tells me that I have to create monsters the same way I create characters, I'm like, yep, done. You can just go on, Chef.
That was the hardest part of D20 for me, especially publishing D20 supplements, because I did D20 modern supplements, and to build.
You can't even like cheat D20 modern characters.
No, it's brutal. Now there was actually a I'm trying to remember where I found it. I think it was Stan ! On his website had a basic. Step by step, and a example how to quickly build D20 modern NPCs. But quickly is, yeah, especially the stuff that I was making for Sword Edge Publishing, the adventures were for relatively high level, because they were supposed to be like special operations guys. They're special forces, so these guys are going to be relatively high level. So the challenge.
Yeah, they've got that first advanced class pack.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I mean, you're talking basically most of it was for characters level 9 to 11, and meaning that the big bad and most of the top villains had to equally be in the 6 to 10 level range. And building a 10th level character in D20 Modern was quite a task.
And it wasn't like the line got a ton of support the way standard D&D did, where you had 5 bestiaries you could just sort of crib guys off of. And then I got a lot of mileage out of Player's Handbook 2 with the very fast and dirty character generation chapter at the back.
Yeah. And again, speaking as a publisher, it was a double-edged sword with the lack of support from D20 Modern, because it forced people that enjoyed D20 Modern to go look at third-party publishing, whereas a lot of D&D people just refused to, because they said, you know, it's not Wizards, it's not D&D. Well, if you enjoyed D20 Modern and wanted to play that, you were basically out of luck if you were waiting for Wizards of the Coast to deliver anything. So people were almost forced to look at third-party. So a place like RPG Objects could grow and did grow quite well through its D20 Modern line. And I mean, that's how we got our start, and we did okay. Not nearly nothing for D20 Modern sold as well as Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe have been. But it was enough, and we got enough fan support to keep plugging away until D20 Modern just went to its grave, and then we were done.
Yeah. Well, and that was the downward spiral of people saw promise in it, but didn't like the lack of support, and so they bought less, and it got supported less,
yep.
So it all just went down. And then the same thing almost kind of sort of happened with Star Wars.
Yeah, unfortunately. And I didn't play Star Wars. I've played it maybe once or twice. Co-host on Accidental Survivors, Rob Wakefield, he's run it a few times. But, I mean, I don't have any of the books or anything like that, so I can't really comment on that. But I have heard from others how great the Star Wars rules, the Saga Edition, was.
Yeah, no, they were great, but... Okay, What else did I have to ask about Kiss My Ex? Is that... I'm trying to think of anything else I would like to know. I don't think there is.
Well, we've got one adventure out.
So tell me a little bit about writing adventures for Crazy Viking Mayhem.
The adventure that is out now, Suffer the Witch, is from this many-storied Gen Con experience. It was designed specifically for Games on Demand and worked out so well there that I decided I was just going to publish it, especially as I didn't include any adventure in Kiss My Axe itself. Suffer the Witch has everything that you might want to do with Vikings. There's lots of chance for you to beat things up. There is the supernatural. There is the possibility of dealing with interpersonal and social conflict. And there's even outright investigation. So it's all right there. And it should be playable within 4 hours. The characters that were used, the pre-gen characters that were used, are included. So you can actually run the characters that I had prepared for Gen Con that were used. Everybody who played it used these characters. But of course, I mean, if you want to build your own characters, that's fine. But it's built for characters starting right out of the gate. So if your characters, if you've been playing for a bit and your characters have advanced, the challenge isn't going to probably be strong enough for more experienced characters. But basically the story is that your Vikings, however you would like, find themselves marooned on the shore near this village of Kulvid. And in that village is suffering. The chieftain tells you the village is suffering under the curse of a witch, and that he's tried many times to destroy this witch and has failed each time. And any man that faces her is going to die. So it's up to your war band of Vikings. Do they save this village? Do they, you know, pillage it for raw materials to build a ship? It's totally up to you. In general, it's assumed that they're going to try to do something. But yeah, that's Suffer the Witch. And it shows really how simple an adventure can be. And again, it's only supposed to be for 4 hours. As opposed to a campaign, if you're interested in hearing a long campaign, I recorded a lot of the True 20 Viking campaign from which Kiss My Axe came, and that's available on herlid.blogspot.com, H-E-R-L-I-D, which is the Old Norse for warband. So if you're interested in seeing how you can have a long campaign based on seeking for the Bulgar gold, you can go to herlid.blogspot.com and hear how we did that.
All right. And I guess, what do you think is going to be next for Sword's Edge? Some more adventures for your current stuff, new products?
It's unknown. What's in playtesting right now, actually the playtesting starts tomorrow, is a game called Centurion, Legionaries of Rome, which, as you might guess from its title, is about playing a legionary from Rome.
All right. But is it the Lost 11th Legion? Because apparently everyone is sick of those stories.
Centurion, the movie, actually, that's not where it's not supposed to be based on that. They share a name. That's all. Centurion, the movie, was – I didn't mind. I like Neil Marshall anyways. But that Eagle of the Ninth movie, I haven't seen and honestly have no interest.
Yeah. But so, yes. Well, a game of doing Roman things. What do you do for Roman
things? And I mean, it's specifically supposed to be legionary. And if it does go to production, and there's no guarantee that it will because – playtesting might reveal it to be just a total loss. But if it goes to production, the idea is to have a game that can span the legionary experience of the Republic, the Civil Wars, the period around Pompey and Julius Caesar and Augustus, the what's called the Principate, which is your early Imperial Rome that most of us are most familiar with when we hear names like Nero and Claudius and Caligula, right up into what's called the Dominate, which is leads up into the fall of Rome after the crisis of the second century. But in any case, right now, it's very similar in its basis to the Sword Edge system, like Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe, in that it requires qualities, but the dice mechanic is totally different. It's going to be kind of a dice pool mechanic. And one of the things that playtesting is going to do, we're going to see if this will actually work, if it's interesting, if it slows down the game. There's been a lot of research already done on legionary life and adventuring. So that might come out even if I don't have a game for it, more as a systemless guide to gaming as a legionary in Rome.
All right. Well, if it does make it to production, obviously your chapter, your section on dice mechanics has to be titled Alia Eata Est.
Absolutely. So you've taken your college Latin, I see.
No, I never sat down. Well, I was almost briefly maybe a classical studies major,
okay.
And then I just have picked up philosopher's Latin since then.
Yes.
Which is that there's also philosopher's Greek and philosopher's French and philosopher's German. None of it especially useful, except for a handful of handy phrases that you can just use one word to describe a whole set of ideas very fast.
Well, the only thing I remember from my university Latin, the two Latin classes I took, which amounted to one credit, was Ea Magna Pulchra Est. She's very attractive. That's the only thing that I remember.
Yeah.
So there's also a possibility of doing a modern game. One of the primary reasons why I started Sword Edge Publishing was to publish a book on role-playing special operations forces characters, but very specific ones. And it's called Covert Forces because a lot of these groups like the SAS and Delta Force and Canada's own JTF2 do have roles as direct action roles where they some of them go undercover, but they have clandestine missions and that sort of thing. So it's not so much the counterterrorism, the bursting into a building, the flashbangs and rescuing the hostages. It's more the long shadowing the enemy, pathfinder type activities that might lead to sabotage or anti-terrorism campaigns, for example, killing terrorist leaders, that sort of thing. And I did publish it for D20 Modern, and I published it and then reissued it in a better way. I fixed it, and that was Covert Forces Redux. And I'm actually thinking, after discussions with one of my buddies, Bradley Clark, who's in the Canadian military and is usually the guy that I talk to about things like guns and ships and tanks and stuff, talking with him about Sword's Edge system and modern military campaigns and my insistence that it certainly can work. So if Centurion doesn't get off the ground, then I might try Covert Forces. I don't know what the trifecta or whatever, using Sword Edge system.
Well, I don't know. You almost want to do like : Sword Team edition. Get the sword in there.
The pointy edge of the sword. But you know, the SAS have got swords in their patch, so it all fits. I think JTF2 does as well. There seems to be a theme going there.
Yeah, Spec Ops guys like their pointy implements.
Yes. As do Vikings. So there's also that link in.
As do Vikings. Yeah, all full circle.
It all comes back to the Vikings.
Always the Vikings. But, okay. And my usual last question, because this is a website where no matter what I do or say, more attention will be devoted to whatever Square Enix has come up with this particular week. Do you have any particular favorite video game RPGs?
And here's the funny thing. I don't really play video games.
That's
I played Civilization. It's not really a role-playing game. But, yeah, the last role-playing role-playing game, video game that I played was Oh, crap. Baldur's Gate. So that goes back, what, 2000? 1999? Something like that.
98, 99.
Yeah. So there you go.
Well, Minsk was awesome.
I didn't get really, and this may be why I don't play them anymore. I didn't really get that far in Baldur's Gate. But if you want to talk, my favorite all-time role-playing video game is Darklands, and this is way back in the day, where you were playing in Renaissance Germany that had things like undead and goblins and things like this.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to remember. Like, they did this whole thing of, like, using actual German folklore to build
yep.
a setting.
And, the armor, everything was historically accurate. You would build your characters following, like, life paths. And it was all very similar to how you would have lived in Germany. I mean, the whole thing was, I'm not going to say it was totally historically accurate, but it was very well researched and certainly on the surface seemed that way. I'm not sure about this, but it certainly seemed like it was built on a tabletop role-playing game. The mechanics and the way you built characters and everything else just seemed like that. And perhaps it was the time period. Perhaps it was much more common for it to flow that way as opposed to now where it's going the other. But it really did remind me of a role-playing system, a tabletop role-playing system. And while the role-play itself, the interaction was not particularly great, the art was actually fantastic. So you didn't get a lot of moving graphics, but you would have these pages that you would go to. So, for example, if you went to an apothecary, there'd be like almost like a sketch, like a pencil sketch of the apothecary or the apothecary's off store or whatever. And the art was just very well done. It was very, very attractive, the game itself. So that's always been my favorite role-playing experience as a video game. So I guess that makes me very old school.
All right, and feel free to shout out to any links you want people to find your stuff at, and hopefully buy
tons of it. Well, you can get
buy two.
That's
copies.
Right. One for you, one for me. But it's all available at RPG Now, rpgnow.com. If you're interested, you can pop by swordsedgepublishing.ca, which is should give you some information on the products. If you are uncertain but would like to see what the system is like, again, Sword Edge System, SES, is free, again, at rpgnow.com. So go there. And if you're going to be picking it up, if you think you might want the adventures as well, both Sword Noir and Kiss My Axe are in bundles right now. So you can get them at – you can get the whole Megillah at a reduced price.
Which was how I bought Sword Noir, because it's very hard for me to not – it's very hard to justify not spending an amount under $10 for something. That's
yeah. Yes. And the good thing with that, the good thing with the Sword Noir bundle is you actually end up with three adventures. Because the Sword Noir book itself has an adventure in it, and then the bundle includes two others. And they all have a slightly different atmosphere to them, a slightly different, I'm not going to say genre, but focus. So I thought that was a conscious decision based on – each one of them is actually based on a story concept, none of which have been published yet, but very different main characters. So they had there were very different atmosphere, I'll say.
All right, and thanks for coming in and chatting.
Yeah,
and,
thanks for having
we'll
me.
We'll see how things go for you in the future.
Oh, let's hope it's good.